not going to say anything more about slide 8. But I do want to talk about slide 9. And, whoops. Slide 9 gives you some anatomical information. We don't get too specific on anatomical information in here because it's mostly a physiology class, of course. But it's important to talk about this part of anatomy with respect to the two main control organ systems. Right now we're on the endocrine system. We'll be talking about the nervous system right after this. And this is the best illustration of where these two control organ systems overlap anatomically and physiologically. What you're looking at here is a close-up of a little section of the brain. The hypothalamus is a region of the brain, a primary division of the brain called the diencephalon. That includes the thalamus and the epithalamus, the subthalamus, and the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus gets its name just from the fact that it is below the thalamus. That's what hypothalamus literally means. And the hypothalamus does a lot of important brain stuff. But what we're going to talk about right now is its contribution to the endocrine system. It's definitely part of the nervous system because it's part of the brain. It's made up of neurons, but it's also part of the endocrine system because some of those neurons are neuroendocrine neurons, meaning that what they release are not neurotransmitters, but neurohormones. The difference, of course, is not a chemical distinction, and the difference is that neurohormones are released into the bloodstream, as I discussed. Well, the hypothalamus is connected to what is usually called the pituitary gland that hangs below it. The pituitary gland is at least half a misnomer, so I don't like to use that term. A better word for the pituitary gland is the hypophysis. A word that means growth below. And the reason that this is a better term is because it describes it fully. It's not fully a gland. You can see from the two colorings here on the figure that the hypophysis is really two different structures that happen to be connected to each other, and therefore we can see it as one structure macroscopically, but there's two distinct types of tissue. The front part, or the anterior part of the hypophysis, is a true gland. That's the only part that is actually glandular. And that part, other than being called the anterior pituitary, is properly called the adenohypophysis. What does adeno mean? Anyone know what adeno means? It means gland. So adenoid, for instance, means gland-like. The adenohypophysis, or anterior pituitary, is made up of a population of cells that are just ordinary endocrine cells, meaning that they produce hormones. And so this is an endocrine gland. The back part, though, the posterior pituitary, is made up of axons, which are parts of neurons, axons of neurons that start out and have their cell bodies up in the hypothalamus. The posterior pituitary, therefore, is properly called the neurohypophysis. And since it's made up of neurons that have their cell bodies up in the hypothalamus, the neurohypophysis is really an extension of the brain. It's part of the brain. But reflecting these totally different functions, these two pieces of the hypophysis develop from entirely different places. Naturally enough, the neurohypophysis develops as an outpocketing of the brain, because that's what it is. The adenohypophysis develops from the roof of the mouth as an upward pocketing, and they just happen to come together into the overall hypothesis. By the way, the stalk that connects the hypothalamus to the hypophysis is called the infundibulum. That word means funnel, because this is a funnel-shaped stalk. And the bone right here that this hypophysis is resting in is the sphenoid bone of the skull. Slide 10 gives you a better view of this, of just the back, what's going on in the back part, in the posterior pituitary or neurohypophysis. You can see from this that the neurohypophysis is made up of axons. The axons are the long parts of neurons, the nuclei of neurons are located in what the big part of a cell, of a neuron, which is called the cell body. Those are up in the hypothalamus. And so that's where the DNA is for that cell, naturally, for a nucleus. That's where things are manufactured, because that's where the ribosomes are as well. And so the proteins, the various proteins that the neuron needs, but the proteins including neurohormones are manufactured up in the brain part of these neurons and then have to be transported down the length of the axon to get to the axon terminal. The distal end of a neuron is an axon terminal. Distal is the far end, and it's the reason it's far is because we're thinking of things in terms of the flow of information. The flow of signals goes from cell body end to axon terminal in most neurons like this. So the there's millions of these bundled together side by side, these axon fibers. That's what makes up the neurohypophysis. When these neurons are stimulated, they release their chemical signals, which are their neurohormones. And those make their way, as you see, into the bloodstream, into the general circulation from the neurohypophysis. There's two neurohypophyseal neurohormones that are released: oxytocin and, there's how oxytocin is spelled, and antidiuretic hormone, which is ADH. We might talk about those in detail later, but this is the overview of the neurohypophysis. The front is more complicated. The adenohypophysis is the glandular part. So it's made up of separate cells that are not extensions of cells that start out in the brain. But there are shorter neurons in the hypothalamus, shorter than the ones that go down into the neurohypophysis. These shorter ones also produce neurohormones. But those neurohormones are released from the axon terminals of those short neurons all the way up in the hypothalamus. The piece of the circulation that they are released into is a special part which is called a portal system. There are three portal systems in the body. This is one of them. It's called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Do I need to spell that? Okay. Just how it sounds. So it's just refers to the fact that it involves the hypothalamus and the hypophysis. So that's one portal system. Just to mention the other two, there's a renal portal system in the kidneys, and there's the hepatic portal system involving the liver and the gut. Anyway, what makes something a portal system? Well, it's an exception to the circulatory rule. Usually, in most cases, you have the heart, and then arteries, and then capillaries, and then veins, and then back to the heart. In a portal system, you have the heart, arteries, a capillary bed, the first of two capillary beds, then larger vessels that then become small again into a second capillary bed, two serially arranged capillary beds without the heart in between, and then back to the heart. And There's only three places in the body where that occurs. This is one of them. So the first capillary bed is the capillaries up in the brain, up in the hypothalamus, that receive those neurohormones from the axon terminals of these hypothalamic neurons. Then they travel this short distance through these portal vessels that reside in the infundibulum, and then those portal vessels give rise to a second capillary bed that is in the adenohypophysis and surrounds those cells. That's where these neurohormones released from the neurons up in the hypothalamus make their way out of this second capillary bed and therefore can reach their targets, all of which are only on cells of the adenohypophysis. So even though these hypothalamic hormones can go all through the body because there's nothing stopping them once they're in the circulation, they don't do anything anywhere else in the body because they're the only cells that have receptors for them are in the adenohypophysis. All right? This slide 11 gives you the names and abbreviation, well, it gives you the abbreviations of, the book gives you the names, of these hypothalamic hormones that are involved with the adenohypophysis. Of course, oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone are also hypothalamic hormones, but they are released from the neurohypophysis. Well, this is the most complicated part of the endocrine system because it involves a series of hormones. And the things that are released from the hypothalamus itself, which are these things listed on the top, are either releasing or inhibiting hormones. That's how they're classified functionally, because they either increase the release of a hormone from the adenohypophysis, or they decrease the release of a adenohypophyseal hormone. Okay, so they work on only the cells of the adenohypophysis, and a releasing hormone will tell it to release more hormone, an inhibiting hormone will tell it to tone it down. So let me just quickly go through these names. Notice that some of them are in pairs, meaning that there's antagonistic control exercised. Those are the ones that you see in pairs. Right here's a pair and right there's a pair. So these PRFs, these dopamine, that's an antagonistic pair. PRF stands for prolactin releasing factor. And it's called that because when it reaches the proper cells down in the adenohypophysis, its effect on those cells is for those cells to release prolactin. So the name makes sense. Dopamine is the antagonist to PRFs. So if dopamine reaches those same cells that produce prolactin, it tells them to not produce as much. That's antagonistic control. Other control, though, is tonic. Remember the difference between tonic and antagonistic control? Tonic is controlled by just one neuron. So there aren't opposites to all of these. TRH stands for thyrotropin-releasing hormone. Tropin, that suffix, refers to activating something. So thyrotropin-releasing hormone is not a thyrotropin because it does not activate the thyroid gland. Thyrotropin-releasing hormone causes cells in the adenohypophysis to release the thyrotropin itself. That thyrotropin is called thyroid-stimulating hormone. Okay? So thyrotropic means acting on the thyroid. Thyroid-stimulating hormone is the thyrotropin. But what causes release of that is thyrotropin-releasing hormone. Any questions on that? Yeah. I didn't hear the beginning of that. Oh, well, yeah, there will be effects at the final target tissue, but they don't necessarily have to be profound effects. It depends on how much of an imbalance there is upstream. But notice that prolactin has as its ultimate effector organ the breast. Prolactin, the name prolactin, means promoting lactation. Lactation is the production of milk, not the release of milk. the production of it in the glands of the breast, in the mammae, as they're called. So it's still stored in there. There's a separate hormone that takes care of actually ejecting that milk through the nipple. That's one of oxytocin's jobs. Okay, so the thyroid-stimulating hormone, once it's released from the adenohypothesis, goes into the general circulation, eventually makes its way to the thyroid gland and causes its release, still another hormone. And so this is why this is the most complicated part. You have a releasing hormone released from the hypothalamus that causes the release of a hormone from the adenohypophysis, which then travels to some target tissue, which in some cases releases still a third hormone. Now, CRH stands for corticotropin-releasing hormone. A corticotropin is something that acts on the cortex of something. In this case, it's the adrenal cortex. Cortex, remember, is a general word that means the superficial part of a structure. And so corticotropin-releasing hormone travels down the portal system and tells the appropriate cells to release ACTH, which is adrenocorticotropic hormone. So that's the actual corticotropin. Corticotropin-releasing hormone is not a corticotropin. It doesn't act directly on the cortex. It tells cells of the adenohypophysis to release adrenocorticotropic hormone, which is the corticotropin. And it's the corticotropin because adrenocorticotropic hormone goes to the adrenal cortex, which is its target tissue, and then tells it to release more hormones. The principal hormone that it causes it to release is cortisol, which is a stress hormone. All right, and notice that these last in the line of hormones affect many tissues by and large. There are a couple specific things, but many tissues are affected by these final hormones in line, including cortisol. Now, the second pair of antagonists, go ahead. Yes.
Are there, like, other things that control it other than just the ACTH?
Well, there are, but they aren't coming from the hypothalamus. They involve feedback from other parts of the body. That's a good question, though, because there are mineralocorticoids, for instance, that are released from the adrenal cortex. There are androgens, and those are getting signals from elsewhere to specifically release just those and not cortisol.
So ACTH doesn't just cause it to release everything?
No. Okay. Right. And that's a really good question because it shows you understand how things are working. Okay, now the other antagonistic control from the hypothalamus involves these two opposites of each other. GHRH stands for growth hormone releasing hormone, which you can probably tell from that name what it does. It releases growth hormone. Where does growth hormone get released from? The adenohypophysis. GH, growth hormone from the adenohypophysis, also has another name. Does anyone know what that is? Somatotropin is the other name for growth hormone. Somato means body. So to activate the body is to get it growing. That's growth hormone. Somatostatin is the opposite of growth hormone releasing hormone. It's also released from the hypothalamus, but it tells the same cells that produce growth hormone not to produce growth hormone. The statin part, as in static, means unchanging. Keep things as they are. Don't grow the body. Keep it as it is. That's why growth hormone inhibiting hormone is its other name. It inhibits the release of growth hormone. Somatostatin does. Okay, and then the last one that's the hypothalamic hormone is GnRH, which is gonadotropin-releasing hormone. A gonadotropin, which this isn't, is something that acts on the gonad. Well, this doesn't have the gonad as a target tissue. This has certain cells in the adenohypophysis as target tissues. But those adenohypophysial cells that GnRH acts on release things that do act on the gonads. So the actual gonadotropins are FSH and LH. And those stand for follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. These are both involved in various aspects of the reproductive system. Now, both sexes have both of these gonadotropins. They happen to be named for what they do in females, but they're exactly the same chemical in both, so we use the same name in males as well. Notice that both of those then act on the gonads to release sex hormones. So that's the way things work in the front part of the pituitary, in the adenohypophysis. And this, so each one of these different cells is another integrating center. Is that clear? Because it's receiving input, dealing with it, producing an output. Slide 12 gives you just a schematic representation of this. You have the hypothalamus involved. That releases what is called a trophic hormone. Actually, most books will call that tropic without the H. Trophic usually refers to eating. Tropic refers to activation. But this book chooses to use trophic here as well. Those are the things like corticotropin releasing hormone that I just discussed. Those travel to the anterior pituitary or adenohypophysis, which then releases its own tropic hormone, because those all act on something else, to release still another endocrine, another hormone from that final gland, and then that final hormone in the series will eventually, once it reaches the target tissues, cause whatever the ultimate effect is. That's the response. But notice that there are two feedback loops here. There's a short loop negative feedback, simply because something that is the intermediate can feed back and tone down what's going on above it, and therefore keep things from building up too much. But you also have long loop negative feedback. So the ultimate, or the third hormone in line, can also feed back. In other words, if you have a lot of the ultimate hormones starting to build up, then that hormone, since it's in the bloodstream, will make its way back to the hypothalamus and tell those hypothalamic neurons, enough. There's enough of this already, so just don't send your signals so that the next thing doesn't send its signals, so that the ultimate gland does not produce more of what we already have. That's classic negative feedback on both, but there's a long loop and a short loop. To just put a specific example to this, this is slide 13. The hypothalamus releases CRH. What does that stand for? Corticotropin releasing hormone. That acts on the anterior pituitary adenohypophysis of certain cells of it, the ones that are responsible for producing ACTH, adrenocorticotropic hormone. That's then put into the bloodstream and travels to the adrenal cortex. Notice it's the outside of this adrenal gland. The adrenal cortex cells that are affected by ACTH produce the stress hormone cortisol, which has effects in many tissues of the body. One of its main jobs is to spare glucose, to keep most of the cells of the body from using glucose, because glucose is the main food of the brain. The brain basically eats glucose only. The other cells of the body can burn other fuels. Well, in a stressful situation, you don't want your brain to shut down, so it tells the rest of the body, eat something else, save the sugar for the brain. Anyway, though, the long loop feedback works because cortisol, if it's elevated, will make its way back to the hypothalamus and tell it to tone down its release of CRH, which affects everything downstream of that. Notice that cortisol also feeds back directly to the adenohypophysis. So it's toning both of these things down, which makes it even more efficient. There's really no new information in slide 14. This just gives you another view of the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, and it just gives you pictures to the various target tissues corresponding to these acronymous hormones, these alphabet soup. I don't think I even have to mention anything about 15. It's just another example, but there's no new information there either. Now, slide 16, I do want to mention, because here we have exogenous cortisol. Endogenous means occurring inside of. So that's the naturally produced hormones that your cells make. And they do their job, of course. But you can also have a hormone introduced into your body. That's exogenous hormone. In this case, in this specific example, it would be exogenous cortisol. Well, once a hormone's in the body, it does the same thing as it would whether it was produced by the body or not. The target tissues can't tell the difference. So cortisol, exogenous cortisol, will affect target tissues the same way as endogenous cortisol will. But notice that it also, that exogenous cortisol is going to operate via negative feedback. So it's going to tell the things that naturally, the upstream structures that naturally are responsible for producing endogenous cortisol to shut down. That's why you have the negative feedback upstairs, but the target tissues are still affected. Slide 17 is a view of what is called the pineal gland, or as some people pronounce it, pineal gland. Pineal means like a pine cone. And this is a this is found in the brain just posterior to the diencephalon, just posterior to the thalamus. This is the thalamus. And the pineal gland is embedded in there pretty deep, but it's conspicuous when you open up a dissected brain. And this pineal gland, we didn't know much about it for a long time, but we're still learning about it. It is responsible for releasing what is called melatonin. The reason it's called melatonin is really because of its effect in other mammals. Melatonin tones down the production of melanin. Melanin is a black pigment that a lot of animals use. Well, if an organism produces less melanin, that animal is whiter. And so that happens seasonally, for instance, in some things that live in climates that change drastically want to be white in the winter to blend in. They want to be dark other times. That's why it was named. It doesn't really have that effect in us so much. But melatonin is important for sleep-wake cycles. Melatonin is actually produced, as you see in this graph, it's produced while sleeping, and then it's real low levels during wakefulness. And so this not only entrains the brain for what are called circadian rhythms, things that's why your body knows what time it is, basically, without looking at clocks. That's why you get tired the same time of day, whether you do anything or not that day. Those sleep-wake cycles are partially regulated by melatonin cycles. And the reason that it's produced at night is because when the eyes are not receiving light, that's a signal to the brain for the pineal gland to release melatonin. But we're learning more and more about it. For instance, it's also probably an important antioxidant, which is probably one reason why sleep is important, because it actually can repair the body or prevent damage that free radicals would do to the body. That's what antioxidants' job is, to basically deal with free radicals, to keep them from destroying parts of your cells. All right, that's that chapter. That's a quick overview of the endocrine system. Anything I need to deal with before we go to chapter 8, which is the nervous system? Yeah. Oh, a free radical is just anything that has an unpaired electron. Electrons particles are a lot more stable if there are paired electrons, because orbitals fill up with pairs. So an unpaired electron is a half-filled orbital, which is an unstable situation. And so that to be be more stable, it's going to require an electron from somewhere else to make it stable, and then that's going to turn that something else that it gets the electron from into a free radical, and it's going to be a chain reaction, and it can drastically affect the molecular usefulness of whatever it grabs that electron from. Antioxidants are able to stop that process without themselves becoming free radicals. Anything else while I switch slides, shows? Okay, well, this is dealing with chapter 8, but this first slide isn't from your book. It's just something I made to explain the breakdown of the overall nervous system. You have one overall nervous system, of course, but for convenience, it's broken down several ways. First of all, there is the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Those are the two primary divisions of the overall nervous system. The central nervous system is simply the brain and the spinal cord. Peripheral, meaning around the edges, is all of the rest of the nervous system, anything but the brain and spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system, as you see, is then further subdivided into an efferent division, which is also called a motor division, because it sends outward signals to effector organs. Okay, it makes things happen. Effector organs, by the way, of the nervous system are glands or muscles. The afferent division, on the other hand, otherwise called the sensory division, carries inputs to the central nervous system. So you have sensory receptors that respond to stimuli, like heat, for instance. That information is sent via neurons of the afferent division, part of the peripheral nervous system, to the central nervous system. All right, then the efferent or motor division is further subdivided into the somatic motor nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. Somatic, once again, means body, which is kind of a misnomer because, of course, everything's part of your body. But here it refers to skeletal muscles. The somatic motor nervous system innervates or connects to skeletal muscles only, which are the kinds of muscles that move your body parts, the things that you really think of when you're talking about muscles. But there are, of course, also two other kinds of muscles: smooth muscle that line internal organs, and cardiac muscle that makes up your heart. Those are not targets of neurons of the somatic motor nervous system. Only skeletal muscle is. The other effectors, which are the glands plus the other two types of muscle I just mentioned, are target tissues of the autonomic nervous system. Autonomic is the adjective of autonomy. Autonomy is self-control. So the autonomic nervous system controls things in the background. You don't have to think about it. In fact, you're not allowed to decide to do it. You don't have to remember to beat your heart. You don't have any say as to the peristalsis in your gut, for instance. Those are things that are taking control by the autonomic nervous system. On the other hand, you do decide when to bend your elbow. That's involving the somatic motor nervous system. That's a skeletal muscle. All right, and then finally, the autonomic nervous system is broken down further. All books will say that these first two listings here are divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Those are the sympathetic and the parasympathetic divisions. And some books will say that the autonomic nervous system also includes the enteric nervous system. Other books will say that the enteric nervous system is its own separate system. There are good arguments for both, but in either case, the enteric nervous system it gets its name enteric, meaning of the gut, because there's a whole system of a hell of a lot of neurons associated just with the alimentary canal, which is the lining, which is the continuous tube from mouth to anus, the digestive tract, in other words. A whole system of neurons associated with that can actually operate independently of the central nervous system. But of course, they are connected to neurons that come from the central nervous system, so the central nervous system can have its say as to the workings of the enteric nervous system if it wants. Well, anyway, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic divisions are truly divisions of the autonomic nervous system, no matter how you define things. And they are innervating these behind-the-scenes things like the heart, the gut, and glands. And many target tissues of these of the autonomic nervous system are dually innervated, meaning that they are innervated by both parasympathetic neurons and sympathetic neurons. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. Like the heart, for instance, has neurons from the sympathetic and the parasympathetic division both innervating it. And when that happens, when there is dual innervation, the general scheme is that these two divisions work antagonistically. So whatever the parasympathetic division does, the sympathetic division will do the opposite. But you can't say in general that the parasympathetic turns things up and the sympathetic turns things down, for instance. It depends on what the target tissue is. The sympathetic division, for instance, turns down the digestive system. Parasympathetic division turns it up. Just the opposite for the heart, though. The sympathetic division turns the heart up. Parasympathetic division turns it down. But there are also other target tissues that are innervated by only the sympathetic division and not at all by the parasympathetic division. So that's tonic control versus antagonistic control. All right, so that's the general breakdown of the names of these systems that hopefully will make sense to you now when you read about them. Slide 2 gives you much the same information, but this is just more of looking at it physiologically. The central nervous system, as I said, is brain and spinal cord. Some cells called efferent neurons start out, by which I mean their cell bodies are in the brain or the spinal cord, but then they leave the central nervous system, their axons do, and become part of nerves. There are autonomic neurons, somatic motor neurons. Those are both efferent neurons because they're both carrying information away. They're both carrying information toward effectors, and those effectors include cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and so on, as said. By the way, there are four terms I should probably tell you about that are just conventionally defined, but they might be at odds with what you already have in mind as your own definition. A group of axons bundled together, side by side, like a cable, occurring in the peripheral nervous system is called a nerve. So nerve does not refer to a cell, unless you say nerve cell. But the better way of saying nerve cell is saying neuron. That's a single cell always. Anyway, a bundle of those axons, if they are part of the peripheral nervous system, they're outside of the brain and spinal cord, that is a nerve. A bundle of cell bodies that's outside of the central nervous system, or in other words, that's part of the peripheral nervous system, is called a ganglion. Okay? Now you can have both of those situations also occurring in the brain or spinal cord in the central nervous system, but they have different names. So a bundle of axons occurring in the central nervous system, does anyone know what that's called? That is a tract. T-R-A-C-T. And a bundle of cell bodies, neuron cell bodies, that is, in the central nervous system. Anyone know what that's called? That's a nucleus. Good. So that's an entirely different use of the word nucleus. Nucleus is a subcellular structure. Nucleus can also mean a group of neuron cell bodies in the central nervous system. So you just have to know from context what a book or what I am talking about when using those words. Okay, so notice that all of this, the afferent information is coming from outside, I mean it's coming into the central nervous system because of stimuli that are occurring either outside the body at the surface or within the body at some sort of sensory receptor. The general scheme, though, is information travels into the central nervous system because the central nervous system is where the integrating centers of the nervous system are located. Those are neurons of some sort, but they are the integrating centers. They are the ones that receive the input, deal with it somehow, decide whether there needs to be anything done. In other words, decide whether the error is big enough to do anything about it. And if that error signal is big enough, then it sends efferent information out through other parts of the peripheral nervous system, through nerves, to effector organs, which then cause some sort of response that is appropriate for negative feedback, and therefore undo that error homeostatically. Well, it's not time, I guess, we would look at an actual neuron, since we've been talking about them for several lectures. Not all neurons look like what this cartoon in slide 3 shows you, but this is a typical, especially peripheral nervous system neuron. They are long cells. You know, most cells of the body are just compact spheres, basically. But neurons are very long, can be very long cells. They can be up to a meter in length. You know, for instance, it's a single neuron that goes from tip of a toe to the spinal cord, or tip of the finger to the spinal cord. That can be, in a huge person, quite long. That's all one cell, but it's a very narrow diameter, so it still has a high surface area to volume ratio, which is important for there to be enough exchange of materials to service that cell, keep it alive. Well, the nucleus resides in the cell body, which is still a small thing, of course, because this is a cell, but it's a lot bigger diameter, the cell body, is than the axon, which is the slender stalk that emanates from the cell body and is the output in terms of the flow of information. Also connected to the cell body, though, are one or more dendrites. Dendrite means tree-like. And that's because they have what some books will call branches. Really, dendrites, I prefer not to say, are branched. Rather, they have tributaries. Understand the difference between a branch and a tributary? A branch, it depends on the flow of information. For instance, if things are going this way, one thing branches into two. But tributaries are convergences. This is a divergence for a branch. Things coming together, like small streams, are tributaries to one bigger river. Okay? And since dendrites are inputs, these things are really tributaries that converge onto this bigger stalk that connects directly to the cell body. They're inputs because they receive chemical signals from other cells, which can be other neurons. All right, so the output of one cell is going to be a neurotransmitter in general, or usually. Those neurotransmitters can be released onto dendrites of downstream neurons. That would be a serial arrangement of neurons. Anyway, the dendrites are inputs. The cell body is really the integrating center of the neuron because it deals with these various inputs that it's receiving. And strictly speaking, the integrating center is not just the overall cell body, but a place where the cell body gives rise to the axon, and that's called the axon hillock. All right. So the very beginning of the axon is where all of these signals get integrated or added together to determine whether there's going to be an output. And the output of a neuron is in the form of an action potential, which we'll have much more to say about. Now, some cells, some neurons, are myelinated, meaning that they have these myelin sheaths on them, which are made up of other cells that we'll talk about. But myelin sheaths are electrical insulators, basically, of these axons. And they, if a neuron has myelin sheaths, then the speed of propagation or flow of action potentials from the axon hillock to the axon terminal, which is the very end of the neuron is much faster than if that neuron does not have myelin sheaths. An action potential is going to propagate or travel down the length of an axon either way, but it'll take much longer in a non-myelinated axon. Okay. Also shown here is the connection between the end of one neuron and the beginning of another. That's called a synapse. But actually, not all synapses involve two neurons. All synapses involve one neuron, which is the upstream cell, and therefore that one is often called the presynaptic cell. But what comes at the other end of the synapse can be another neuron or some other thing, like a muscle or a gland. And so whatever that is, it's called the postsynaptic cell. The synapse itself includes, anatomically, that axon terminal of the upstream neuron, a small space between the two, because it's not a direct connection, and that small space is called the synaptic cleft. And then the little bit of plasma membrane that is adjacent to that synaptic cleft in the postsynaptic cell is also part of the synapse. And by the way, speaking of synapses, there are two functional types. Most of them are chemical synapses. The reason that they're called chemical synapses is because there is a transduction step. Remember, transduction refers to converting one type of signal into another type of signal. So for a chemical synapse to operate, an action potential, which is an electrochemical signal, or if you prefer to think of it just electrical, that reaches the axon terminal, and its direct effect is to cause release of a neurotransmitter, which is a chemical signal. That's why it's a chemical synapse. That chemical signal then, that those neurotransmitters can have the ultimate effect in the downstream cell of causing another action potential in it. But the action potential doesn't travel directly from the upstream to the downstream cell. There's this chemical intermediator called a neurotransmitter, which is a chemical. Other kinds of synapses, though, which are comparatively rare, are called electrical synapses. And in those, specialized gap junctions that occur between the two cells allow direct flow of ions, and that direct flow of ions is flow of electrical signal because ions have electrical charge. And so an action potential can travel from one upstream cell directly to the downstream cell without this chemical stage in between. That's an electrical synapse. A good example of that are cardiac myocytes, which are the muscle cells of the heart. It's important for the heart, since it's a pump, for the cells to contract more or less simultaneously. So an action potential is started in a group of cells in the atria that send their action potentials directly to the cells they're connected to. So both of the atria, both of the upper chambers of the heart, contract just about simultaneously. And then slightly later, because of a delay, both of the ventricles contract simultaneously. That helps the blood to be pumped efficiently. Slide 4 shows you different kinds of neurons that you find throughout the body. The picture we just looked at in the last slide is like these efferent neurons mostly. But there, which are motor neurons, of course, of the peripheral nervous system. Sensory neurons can be kind of weird, they can be kind of weird because of the arrangement of their dendrites and cell bodies. The usual scheme, as we just saw, for an efferent neuron is to have dendrites, one or more dendrites connected to the cell body, and then the cell body gives rise to one axon. Now that single axon, though, can branch. I didn't mention that. But if it does branch, those branches are called collaterals or collateral axons. But there's never multiple axons coming directly from a cell body. It'll start out as one axon hillock, and then that single axon could branch. That's how most of the neurons are. Sensory neurons, though, notice, can be classified as either pseudo-unipolar, which some books will just call unipolar, or bipolar. The difference is how the cell body connects with these stalks. Pseudo-unipolar gets this name because the dendrite and the axon really form one continuous cable that is connected to the cell body, but kind of indirectly. If you were to hack this cell body off, you would still have a continuous cable. Of course, it wouldn't work anymore, but that's why it's unipolar. Bipolar means two poles, one dendrite, one axon. The dendrite ends at the cell body, and then the cell body gives rise to the axon. By the way, these other ones are called multipolar because there are multiple dendrites plus an axon. So, multiple poles. Now, the ones of the central nervous system can be especially weird and varied. They also, as you see, can have just a hell of a lot of dendrites. And so there are not only billions and billions of brains, trillions of cells that make up your brain, but each of these can have literally thousands of connections with other cells. So if you compute the possibilities of circuit pathways, it's a hell of a lot. Anyway, those are all axons, so they're all single cells, but they differ quite a bit in their architecture. Slide 5 gives you a view of how things have to occur for there to be release of neurotransmitter from the axon terminal of a neuron. Most neurotransmitters are proteins, and proteins can't be made within axon terminals. The axon terminal doesn't include the right subcellular machinery to make the proteins. So those proteins have to be made up in the cell body, wherever that cell body is. That's where the ribosomes and the endoplasmic reticulum that are necessary for the protein synthesis are located. And so when those protein hormones are made up in the cell body, they are packaged in vesicles, membrane-bound vesicles, which then have to travel down the length of the axon in order to be stored temporarily in the axon terminal, because it's the axon terminal from which neurotransmitters are released into the synaptic cleft onto receptors on the surface of whatever the postsynaptic cell is. Well, that takes some time. There's actually a fast and a slow method. The slow method moves these vesicles just gradually through the cytosol, and that takes too long if the signals need to be, these neurotransmitters need to be reach the axon terminal quickly. So there's also a fast mechanism that walks these things actively using ATP, walks them with motor proteins along microtubules of the cytoskeleton that is part of all cells and therefore part of neurons. So these blue lines here represent microtubule networks that are part of the cytoskeleton. And there are other proteins called motor proteins that literally using ATP walk whatever they're carrying along the microtubules. That's how things get from place to place in cells. What these motor proteins are carrying in this instance is the vesicle that is a bag full of neurotransmitters that were produced up in the cell body. So when they get to the axon terminal, these vesicles basically hang out until they're given the signal for exocytosis. Exocytosis, of course, allows for fusion of the membrane of the vesicle with the cell membrane, spilling the contents of the vesicle out of the cell. In this case, that means spilling neurotransmitters out into the synaptic cleft. The synaptic cleft, by the way, is extracellular fluid. It's not inside either cell, the pre- or postsynaptic cell. It's a little gap between it. And what is the signal that tells the cell to release these vesicles of neurotransmitter? An action potential. The action potential is the signal that's sent down the length of the axon. And when it reaches that axon terminal, tells the cell that it's time for exocytosis. That's how neurotransmitters are released. And that is the transduction step. That's going from an electrical signal, the action potential, to a chemical signal, the neurotransmitter, or neurohormone or neuromodulator. It works the same way. Now this sixth slide shows you that the nervous system is made up of more than just neurons. Of course, it does contain neurons of various sorts that we just looked at. But actually, most of the cells of the nervous system are not neurons. Neurons are outnumbered at least 10 times, maybe up to 100 times as many other kinds of cells as there are neurons. Well, what's the distinction is that neurons are the excitable cells. There's two kinds of excitable tissues in the body. That's nervous tissue and muscular tissue. What it means to be an excitable tissue is that the cells of that tissue are able to conduct, to propagate action potentials. And only neurons and muscle cells are able to do that. So only neurons are the excitable cells of the nervous system. But there are a lot of other cells that lend support in one way or another to these neurons. And that group of cells as a whole, those supporting cells, are called neuroglia. Or just glia, or glial cells. Any of these things mean the same thing. There's different kinds of neuroglia that have different functions, and there are different kinds of neuroglia when you divide it up into the central and peripheral nervous systems. So they're listed here. There are microglia in the central nervous system. Microglia act as macrophages, which means they're permanent residents in the central nervous system, but they're always on the hunt for debris, things that could do harm to the neurons. And a macrophage is any cell that uses endocytosis to engulf something and get rid of it. That's one function. You also have what are called astrocytes, which is what these things are. Here's an astrocyte labeled. We're learning more and more about astrocytes. They are involved in some signaling as well, even though they're not excitable cells. Anyway, one function which is illustrated nicely here is that they have a bunch of cell processes, things that stick out from themselves, that form little feet around neurons, around the axons of neurons. Around capillaries, I'm sorry. And these cover the capillary and contribute to what is called the blood-brain barrier. So the brain, of course, has to have a blood supply to stay alive. But unlike the blood supply for the rest of the body, in which just about anything can leave the bloodstream and get to those cells, only certain things are able to cross from the blood to the brain, because a barrier is maintained because of these astrocyte processes. You also have what are called oligodendrocytes. Oligodendrocytes are cells, are central nervous system neuroglia that contribute, myelin sheaths to those neurons within the central nervous system that are myelinated. Like I said, not all of them are myelinated. By the way, myelination versus non-myelination is what makes the distinction between white matter and gray matter. Myelin is whitish in appearance, and so myelinated axons make up white matter. Gray matter is either unmyelinated axons or it's cell bodies. Cell bodies are never myelinated. Okay? The reason these are called oligodendrocytes, oligo means several or a few, more than one. Well, an oligarchy is led by not one person. That would be a monarchy. An oligarchy is headed by a few people. Well, anyway, they're called oligodendrocytes because the cell processes that stick out from them form these myelin sheaths around a few separate neurons, not just one neuron. And dendro once again means tree-like. What I haven't mentioned yet are ependymal cells. Ependymal cells are central nervous system only as well. And these, all of these things are central nervous system only. These ependymal cells form a lining, an internal lining, in the spaces within the central nervous system. There are some spaces in the brain and spinal cord that are called either the central canal in the case of the spinal cord, or ventricles in the case of the brain. So the deep part of the brain has no cells in it. It's just a fluid, there are fluid-filled compartments called ventricles that allow for you to get, allow you to fall on your head and not kill yourself is one of their functions. They're shock absorbers, but it also circulates some fluid. Anyway, these ependymal cells line that internal surface, so this upper right part of this figure is a space. That's a ventricle within the brain. And what are these spaces filled with? Cerebrospinal fluid. And that cerebrospinal fluid is produced by these ependymal cells continuously. So there's always fresh cerebrospinal fluid being produced, and then there's always older cerebrospinal fluid being drained, being dumped into the circulatory system. So those are the main neuroglia. By the way, interneurons are not neuroglia. Interneurons are neurons, but interneurons are usually pretty short neurons. They occur in the central nervous system, and so they receive input from one neuron, send output to another neuron. That's why they're called interneurons. They're between neurons. But they are themselves neurons, and therefore they are excitable cells, not neuroglia. So we just looked at the central nervous system ones. There are also a couple neuroglia in the peripheral nervous system, and those are satellite cells and Schwann cells. Schwann cell is the eponym, meaning that it's named after someone. No doubt some white dude from a way back, but dead now. The better name for a Schwann cell is a neurolemmocyte, because Schwann doesn't tell you anything about it. A neurolemmocyte, or Schwann cell, does the same job in the peripheral nervous system as an oligodendrocyte does in the central nervous system, meaning that it wraps around axons to form myelin sheaths. But the big difference, other than being in the peripheral instead of the central nervous system, is that neurolemmocytes will wrap around just a part of a single neuron, whereas the oligodendrocyte forms myelin sheaths on several different neurons. Okay, and satellite cells, we still are learning really about what they're all about. They cover cell bodies of neurons in the peripheral nervous system, and we're not exactly sure why they're necessary, but they must be, or we wouldn't bother to make them. All right, you have a good view in slide 8 of these myelin sheaths. Notice that on this bottom view where you see the cutaway, that it looks kind of like a roll of toilet paper. There's many layers to a myelin sheath. And so these elaborate cell processes from either an oligodendrocyte or a Schwann cell, depending on where you are, will wrap several times around an axon. Well, what it wraps is is an extension of itself, and that cell has cell membrane, right? Plasma membrane. In between the plasma membrane and the normal cell is the cytoplasm. But these cell processes of these myelinating cells squeeze that cytoplasm out, so it's really just a double layer of plasma membrane, okay? And then that double layer of plasma membrane is wrapped several times around the axon. And that insulates that axon. It doesn't allow for passage of things into and out of the neuron through the plasma membrane. I'll explain why that helps later. But notice that there are these little gaps where there aren't myelin sheaths. So a single axon, which is long, has many, many individual myelin sheaths, which are spaced apart, leaving little gaps. And those little gaps are called nodes of Ranvier, which is another acronym. But nodes of Ranvier are little bare spots, meaning that they're the places where the axon plasma membrane is in direct contact with the extracellular fluid. Those have to be there, or action potentials would be totally stopped. You can't have nothing but myelin sheath on the axon, or you're not going to have any action potentials. But if you have just nodes of Ranvier rather than an entirely bare axon, then then the action potential propagation speed is going to be much faster. All right, in the last few minutes, I need to start describing the basis of these potentials that we're going to be talking about. I've talked about action potentials. That's just one kind of potential. So first, let me just define what a potential is. When we talk about a potential for a cell, we're talking about a membrane potential. But the word potential is really shorthand for electrical potential gradient. Now, potential is used for household electricity as well. When we talk about a potential, we're talking about a voltage. In that case, though, it really is a shorthand for a gradient, a difference in charge from one place to another. Okay, that's what a voltage is. And so cells have voltages that we call membrane potentials. It's a difference in charge from one side of the membrane to the other side of the membrane. So if you were to put electrodes, just like if you had a multimeter, you can measure electrical voltage in an AC outlet by putting one prong in one prong in the other. If you put an electrode just outside the plasma membrane and another one just inside the plasma membrane, the multimeter will detect a voltage. That voltage is the membrane potential, or as some books call it, the transmembrane potential. The difference in these two schemes is that electricity from the wall is dealing with separation of electrons, charges carried by electrons, just bare electrons. Whereas in the cell across the membrane, those charges are carried by ions, which are much bigger particles. But they still carry electrical charge that's just like the charge of electrons, right? In fact, they're caused by either a paucity or shortage or a overabundance of electrons. That's how ions are made, right? A neutral atom either gains or loses electrons. Doesn't change anything about its protons, which are also charged, because that's not chemistry. That's physics, nuclear physics. That would change what kind of element it is. So you either gain or lose electrons to become an ion. And if you are an ion, then you carry electrical charge with you. So the way that there can be a voltage across the membrane is simply for there to be an unequal distribution of ions, things that are carrying charge across that membrane. And the reason that there can be that is because ions, since they are charged, don't just diffuse right through the phospholipid bilayer, because charged things are hydrophilic. They don't like being around those nonpolar tails in the interior lining of the plasma membrane itself. But ions can be transported across the membrane through ion channels, which are proteins embedded in the plasma membrane that allow those ions to travel through. In other words, cells can cause redistribution of ions across the membrane and therefore cause a difference in the magnitude of what is called the membrane potential. Okay, now we're going to talk about three different kinds of potentials. A resting membrane potential, which all cells have, whether they're excitable or not. But it's called a resting membrane potential based on excitable cells, because excitable cells can drastically change their resting membrane potential. Another kind is called a local potential. And another word for a local potential is a graded potential. And those can vary in magnitude. And then the third kind, as I've already mentioned, are action potentials. Now notice that all three of them are potentials, so all three of them are voltages, and in all three cases that voltage is the actual unequal distribution of ions across the membrane. But I'll explain the basis of the difference between them next time.